We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday.
After the Independence Day holiday, the convention takes up the compromise hammered out on July 3rd by the Grand Committee. Within minutes, it is clear that this compromise will not be acceptable to the large states, nor will the small states accept anything less. Anger begins to boil over and insults begin to fly. Talk of quitting is heard around the chamber. Mr. Morris suggests that failure to gain a workable compromise will mean death and destruction. First at the hands of our own citizens in acts of armed rebellion, then at the hands of foreign enemies, who will swoop in to conquer whatever is left. There is outrage at the suggestion that Americans could ever do such a thing. George Mason of Virginia rises and passionately asks the delegates not to give up. He swears that he will be buried in Philadelphia before he will give up on the work before them. Will his plea be enough to hold the convention together?
As it unfolded, July 3rd, 1787, was up to that point the hottest day of the year in Philadelphia. And so it was that 11 members of the Grand Committee gathered to discuss the compromise for representation. Keep in mind that this argument has been going on now for 6 weeks or so. It feels like we are never going to get anywhere. But on Monday, July 2nd, we had the dramatic vote in which the small states did not win, but they did not lose on the question of whether or not the Senate would have equal representation or proportional representation. Small states, of course, led by Gunning Benford, had already declared that should they lose on this issue, they were prepared to walk out and seek foreign alliances as individual and independent states, independent nations. It is really hard, I guess, maybe I'm not doing a great job of this, because we look at something from 200 plus years of hindsight, and it's like many things in history. I mean, we look at the Civil War as a foregone conclusion that the Union was going to win because of its superior manpower, industrial capability, and Navy. We look at World War II, and we debate today whether or not the atomic bomb should have been dropped because Japan was already beaten. We argue about whether or not Germany ever really had a chance against the combined power of the European allies plus America. But we look at things, again, with hindsight. And it's easy to see with hindsight, well, of course, this makes sense. But what we forget so often is that at the time, things that are known to us were not known to the participants in question. And the politics of the day, just like today, rule. Someday people are going to look back at our generations and they're going to question some of the decisions we made based on what to them will be extremely obvious. 100 years from now, if the planet has burned to a crisp through a global warming or has cooled off, and nothing ever came of it, there's going to be a lot of second-guessing of us in this particular era, isn't there? And rightfully so. We, because we know how the Constitution ends, and we have placed it on this pedestal of compromise and the great compromise that we're going to get to eventually. So we already know how the story is going to end. And so it's hard for us really to grasp the criticality of that moment and the fact that there was no one in that room who knew what was going to happen. They all believed that the United States needed a central government. The question was, do we make that government strong? Do we make it federal? Do we make it weak? Do we make it a confederation? How do we best represent the entire interests of the whole without, as some felt, without giving up anything for the individual states? And of course, there were those who felt that everything was just fine, it didn't need to be fixed. And there were those who were concerned deeply that had we continued on the path that we were on, disaster was sure to ensue. By the time July 3rd rolled around, the convention, of course, had adjourned. This committee, this grand committee, meets, and the committee is stacked with small state supporters. By this point, from any observational point, it ought to be clear to everyone in the committee, everybody in the convention, that the small states are going to win. They are not going to lose on the issue of whether or not the Senate should be proportional or equal representation. It's going to be equal representation, or they're going to walk. It's really that simple. This upsets a good number of people. Alexander Hamilton has left because he sees no point in this. Madison is furious and seething, and James Madison, the man who once described George Washington's language as rough, is reduced to hurling insults at entire states. The pressure is immense. And under this, all this current, under all of this frustration, under all of this distrust, at one point, one delegate stands and says, I don't trust you, big states. I don't trust you with any power. If you have this power, you will yield it against us. No question about it, I don't trust you. In the midst of all this atmosphere, of course, is the realization Madison has that it isn't large state, small state. It's slave state, non-slave state. If you look at the voting records of Congress over the previous, 8 years, the slave-holding states, and particularly those with heavy slave economies, have always been a voting bloc together, opposed by those states that aren't. Madison knows, he realizes, that slavery really is the dividing issue. And as we've talked about before, this is hard for him because he himself is a slave owner, yet he believes in the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, he believes in the ideals of liberty, and he believes that all men are created equal. And how does he resolve this in his own mind? It's intriguing to me because there's a lot of psychology in this, and there's a lot of similarities between the world today. Humans don't change. That's one of my laws, is that people don't change. They do the same things for the same reasons throughout history with pretty much the same results. They allow themselves to convince themselves that because of technology, this time it'll be different. I'm fascinated by Thomas Jefferson's conversation with Franklin and Adams after he presents to them the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, where he talks about in that first draft that this is the King of England's fault. This is one of the things that King George III has done. He's inflicted slavery upon these states. And we don't like that. Tom Jefferson, of course, owns slaves. Benjamin Franklin is an abolitionist. Adams doesn't. But Jefferson himself says, look, this is an abomination. It's terrible. But I don't have a clue, no idea under heaven, how to get rid of this, how to stop it. I have no idea how to do this. And in the nature of the government that we have, which is not a monarchy, it is not a dictatorship. There's no single person that rules this. There's no one person who controls Parliament and can influence that one way or the other. In a confederation, of course, with each state having one vote and requiring X number of states to make any changes along those lines, either 9 or unanimous, you're never going to get this done. And you almost throw up your hands and say, well, I have no idea how we're going to do this. It's not unlike human beings. I mean, we all have our foibles. We all have our flaws. We all have things in our lives that we wish we could change. But we really have no idea how. We're powerless to do it. In 1914, we see the same thing happen again. We see the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, a man that literally his reign, his country, I mean, they just didn't care, but used as a political ploy to take on a smaller nation, Serbia being accused by Austria-Hungary. Following this, Russia says, oh, you're gonna pick on our little brothers over here, our little cousins, so if you do this, we're going to declare war on you, Austria-Hungary. Austria-Hungary looks north. Germany says, well, you know, look, we don't really want to do this. We don't really want to get involved in this, but if you declare war on Austria-Hungary, you're going to make me, Nicky, Willie writes to Nicky, you're going to make me declare war on you, and I don't want to, but, you know, got to do what we got to do. Then, of course, England and France have their agreements with Russia. And you have this sense of this slow motion just detonation in the sense that everybody knows that this is incredibly stupid, that this is not something we really want to do, but there's nothing anybody can do to stop it. And in some ways, you look at slavery in the 1780s is in the same boat. Yes, there were abolitionist societies. Yes, there were people who wanted to end it. But there was really no functional way to do it. This is one of the reasons I get upset with people who say, oh, the Constitution was written by a bunch of white slave-owning misogynists who hated women and blacks. Well, that is obviously not true. And one of the things I wish I could do, I know we played the Time Machine Day game a couple weeks ago, but what if we could take those people, put them in a DeLorean, send them back to that day and say, okay, you solve it. What are you going to do differently on July 3rd or July 5th of 1787 differently than what those people did there? Because I'm telling you, if you push this issue, if you say slavery will not exist in these United States, you will not have a United States. It's that simple. Now, the ultimate solution, of course, is going to be a civil war and a 13th Amendment. But that's on down the road. At this point, nobody has a clue how to do it. They all suspect that it's going to end up in war. They all believe that the only way the slaveholding states, especially the hard ones, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, they're not going to give up their slaves. Even to a lesser degree, Virginia, although there's some hope there. All of this backdrop going on, all of this vitriol, all this hatred, all this anger towards each other. And as they adjourn, the committee goes to meet. It's the hottest day of the year, and they drone on and on and on and on. Robert Yates of New York speaks to the committee members about his, quote, attachment to the national government on federal principles, unquote. Now, this is an interesting phrase. Because when we think of federal principles, what we think of is the Constitution. When Yates is speaking of federal principles, what he means is equality of representation. He means one state, one vote. It's intriguing that he says this based on federal principles because literally within 48 hours, Robert Yates, who has been one of the leaders of the what are known as the radical Whigs for many, many years, he has been a potent weapon in the fight for liberty. In less than 48 hours, he's going to walk out of this convention and he will become an ardent anti-federalist, solely almost on the basis of the fact that a centralized government of the nature of the Constitution, he feels, is dangerous to liberty. After he speaks, Benjamin Franklin speaks, he puts forth a motion. They're going to modify the motion a little bit. They're going to massage the motion a little bit. But when everything is said and done, they're going to come to a compromise amongst these 11 people. Yes, we agree with this. At least here on July 3rd, we do. What happens on July 5th is going to be another matter. It's coming up. Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show.
Today's media.
Print. Print is dead.
TV.
TV's still sort of there.
Internet.
Internet is there.
All those sources come in our next podcast regarding today's media and how it's changed with social media.
And how it may change in the future.
So listen to us on Lawless Chat from the Podcast 99 Network.
This is The Scotsman.
And this is Drew.
And we are the Ale Evangelist Show, spreading the good news of good booze across the land.
Wine is nice, but beer is better.
It is indeed. So tune in to us on the Podcast 99 Network, where California comes to talk. www.podcast99.com.
There's an old saying, success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. And as the committee presented their report on July 5th, as the convention reconvened after the 4th of July holiday, with a great deal ringing in their ears, remember that they had heard speeches talking about what a great job this convention was doing. They had heard the young law student ask the rhetorical question, hey, how hard can the principles of government really be? That our guys can't come up with a great plan to make it work. They must have been thinking to themselves as they all stood there going, does this kid have any idea how close we are to being foreign vassals? And so as we gather on July 5th, the conversation begins with the committee reporting. And this is what they've come up with for a compromise. It's not long. I mean, imagine sitting virtually 6-7 hours through the hottest day of the year listening to people drone on speeches to come up with this. You ready? Quote, that in the first branch of the legislature, what we will call the House, each state now in the Union be allowed one member for every 40,000 inhabitants of the description reported in the 7th resolution of the Committee of the Whole House, that each state not containing that number shall be allowed one member. That all bills for raising or apportioning money and for fixing salaries of the officers of the government of the United States shall originate in the first branch of the legislature and shall not be altered or amended by the second branch, and that no money shall be drawn from the public treasury but in pursuance of appropriations to be originated in the first branch. That in the second branch of the legislature, each state shall have an equal vote. So that's it. That's what they came up with. After all of that work, after all of that discussion, after all of that arguing, these are the points that they came up with. There, of course, is a very pointed lack of reference to slaves in the representation, the 40,000. They completely leave that out, which immediately raises the question, well, 40,000 representatives of what? 40,000 people of what? You say a representative for 40,000 people, but what does that mean? Does that mean 40,000 with 3/5? Does it mean 40,000 white? Does it mean 40,000 men? Does it mean, what does this mean? And of course, nobody wants to talk about that, but they have to. That's going to come in. Madison is furious. Madison just says, this is nonsense, because really, the idea of the House, the first House, with its 40,000 member representatives, having the exclusive privilege of originating money bills, is, it won't work, he says. If 7 states in the upper branch wish a bill to be originated, they might surely find some member from some of the states in the lower branch that would originate it. There's this idea here that the Senate, what will become the Senate, and is already actually known as the Senate, will start pushing around the House. seven states will organize. They'll get their representatives to go do it. There you go. The idea that they couldn't amend it is of no consequence. Amendment could be handled privately by the Senate to members in the other house. So you'd have this Senate just literally pushing around the junior house. He felt like the convention was reduced to the alternative of either departing from justice in order to conciliate the smaller states and the minority of the people of the United States, or displeasing these by justly gratifying the larger states and the majority of the people. He really felt like he throws up his hands and he says, look, there's no justice here. There's no reality here. We're either going to give up and let the small states push everybody else around, the majority of the nation around, or we're going to do the just thing, and that's going to tick them off, and they're going to walk. It actually kind of reduced to this simple argument. Gouverneur Morris finally stands up, and of course, remember, Gouverneur Morris is kind of an elitist. He believes that we should do away with the states. He believes that, poor people shouldn't vote. He reminds the convention that the nation has to be united. If persuasion does not unite it, the sword will. And he begs that this consideration might have its due weight. He imagines scenes of horror attending civil commotion, which cannot be described. And the conclusion of them will be worse than the term of their continuance, he says. The stronger party will make traitors of the weaker, and the gallows will halter and finish the work of the sword. And how far foreign powers would be ready to take part in the confusions, he could only imagine. He really tries to paint the bleak picture. Look, we've got to be united on this. We've got to come together. We've got to come up with an idea that works here, because if we don't, the country is going to be ripped apart by internal strife, civil war. And following that, when we're done with that, then the foreign powers, the British, the French, the Spanish, are going to come in and just pick over what's left. The argument will go on and on and on. Eldridge Gerry agreed with the committee while he was there, but now that he's in front of the convention, he disagrees with it. He has very material objections to it. Remember, success has many fathers. Failure is an orphan. We were, however, in a peculiar situation. We were neither the same nation nor different nations. We ought not, therefore, to pursue one or the other of these ideas too closely. If no compromise should take place, what will be the consequences, he asks. A succession, he foresaw, would take place, for some gentlemen seemed decided on it already. You can already sense here, friends, and this is the part that I've become struck by over the past couple of weeks. The seeds of this American Civil War, which was about slavery, and I'm sorry, I try to keep my politics out of this, but I will brook no argument about that. The American Civil War was about slavery, period. If you don't believe me, go read the charters, or go read the speeches that were given by Alexander Stevens, called the Cornerstone Speech. Go read the debates, the records of the debates, and the orders of secession, the declarations of secession by each of the states that seceded. There's no question about the issue. And there really is no question here. On July 5th of 1787, they all know this. They just don't want to say it, because they understand that the small states, for the most part, are the slave states. Virginia, yes. And slavery is legal throughout the United States right now, but it's slowly disappearing, particularly in the North. Virginia is a slave state, but Virginia is home to the people who are preaching liberty and equality. The southern states, South Carolina in particular, the firebrands of South Carolina, don't really know if they can trust their Virginian brethren. Georgia, as we've talked about, is a small state population-wise, but it is anticipating, because people are coming to Georgia hand over foot, they're anticipating being a large state very, very soon. Now you'd have a large state that's a slave state, plus the small states that are slave states. If they don't get their way, a secession could be in the future. Some of these gentlemen here already seem decided on it. Two different plans proposed, the result no man can foresee right now. If we don't come to some agreement amongst ourselves, some foreign sword will do the work for us. I think that that's one of the saddest things I've ever read, because it's so true. Two different plans are proposed. In one, equal representation, and the other, proportional representation. And we have no idea, sitting here, which one will work. We don't know. How do we decide? If we decide one way, it's unfair to the majority of the people of the country. If we decide the other way, it's unfair, or at least seemingly unfair, to certain states. And they're going to walk out of here and leave us all open for this. It's almost as if everyone here recognizes we have to do something. We can't keep going the way we're going, but we have no idea what to do, how to do it. We've got some ideas, we've done our research, we've done our work, and we all acknowledge the fact that there's work here that if we don't do it, it's going to be disaster. But none of us want to face the real problem. Imagine a cancer patient going to a doctor. The doctor says, your problem is you have cancer. You need to take cancer treatment. And the cancer patient says, well, but what about some other plans? I mean, this other doctor thinks that we can do, you know, we can treat for arthritis, or we can do this, or we can do that. And we just don't want to face it. We don't want to hear the words. I wrote once upon a time ago about a moment in my own life where, you know, there was a moment where the cancer word came into the conversation. And what I most remarkably remember about that moment is not actually hearing the word. I knew what he was going to say. I knew what he was saying, but I didn't actually hear the word because I didn't want to hear it. Thankfully, it turned out not to be. But in the same way, these men sitting in this room, they know what the real problem is, but they don't have a clue what to do about it. And I would say this to you somewhat out of character and somewhat out of the timeline of what we're doing here on Constitution Thursday. I say to you today that any person today that says they would have done it differently that day is lying to you. Because they would have sat in that same room with the same arguments, with the same problems, and if they put their foot down and say, well, slavery's bad, we're going to do this, small states are going to walk, and you're not going to have a country. You're not going to be able to deal with the evils of slavery, even though it's going to take a civil war to do it. You're not going to be able to solve the social ills. You're not going to be able to solve suffrage. You're not going to be able to do those things because you are going to essentially become vassals in all probability of a foreign power. So anybody that says to you they would have done it differently is either intentionally ignorant or they're lying. One of the two. My guess is that they're intentionally ignorant because they haven't taken the time to study this stuff. They haven't taken the time to think about it. They haven't put themselves in the place of these men in this room at that moment saying to themselves, we got to have a solution. But what is that solution? We just don't know. And believe me, it's about to get really heated, too. It's Constitution Thursday. It's Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bellman Show.
Gotta keep them separated.
In the heat of the moment, people say things that perhaps they did not mean, or perhaps they say things that they wouldn't have otherwise said, that maybe they do mean, but wisdom and politicking would have kept them from saying anyway. But as the convention melts down on July 5th, as speaker after speaker says, well, if you don't settle it my way, the sword will settle it. If you don't do it the way we think you should do it, foreign powers are going to take over. If you don't do it this way, we're going to do it. The intensity of the rhetoric is so ratcheted up. Gunning Bedford of Delaware, will criticize others. Governor Morris, he doesn't like what Governor Morris has said. He doesn't like Governor Morris's description of the Civil War. He thinks that we're above that sort of thing. And how dare Governor Morris even imply that Americans would rebel against themselves, in essence? Oh, what intemperate speech this must be. North Carolina stands up. He pleads for calm. Then points out that Gorham of Massachusetts, Nathaniel Gorham, has been, you know, intemperate. Hey, everybody calm down. Besides, that guy's did it too. Patterson complains about how Madison and Morris are treating the small states. Delegates start standing up. They start talking about, that's it. I'm quitting. I'm going home. In fact, Yates does walk out. He just has had it. He can't do this anymore. He'll write a letter to the governor of New York, and he'll explain that this is a bad idea. There's nothing that can be done that these guys are going to do. Aldrich Gerry calls for compromise. But he does it in a way, and this is one of the interesting things we read about him. He is not a good speaker. For a guy that has gone down in our lexicon throughout our political history, gerrymandering is named after him, he speaks very poorly, a profusion of those hems and haws that never fail to lengthen out and enliven his oratory. He admits that he has very material objections to the committee's report, but we've got to have a compromise. And then George Mason of Virginia stands up. George Mason, of course, he's going to become an anti-federalist. He's not going to sign the Constitution, but he is a leading member and one of the most respected people out of the state of Virginia. He's not very well known, but he's there. He speaks passionately in favor of moderation. He pleads with the delegates to persevere. However liable the committee's report might be to objections, it was preferable to an appeal to the world by the different sides, as has been talked about by some gentlemen. He went on to issue a personal commitment to see the Constitution writing process through to the end. Quote, "It could not be more inconvenient to any gentleman to remain absent from his private affairs than it was for me. But I will bury my bones in this city rather than expose my country to the consequences of a dissolution of this convention without anything being done." Strong words from a man who will become an anti-federalist. He will disagree with the final product, but he will not quit on the product. He will not DOR. He will not leave until the great work is done. Some delegates, of course, will hear this. Most of the delegates will hear this, and they will accept it. If it's good enough for Mason, it's good enough for us. We'll stay too. Some will not. As I mentioned, Robert Yates, Lansing Leave of New York, they throw in the towel. They don't believe that the small states have a chance in any of this. And that consequently, there will be no compromise whatsoever. It just can't happen. Letters are written home to governors and to folks back home. North Carolina writes that the diverse and almost opposite interests that are to be reconciled occasion us to progress very slowly. Rufus King writes to his friend that the convention, quote, has not progressed a single step since you left. New Jersey delegate sounds the same note, writes his governor, William Livingston, says, in the last 10 days, we have not made the least bit of progress in any of this business. And we just can't get past this thing. How do we deal with this representation? Well, the committee's compromise gets ripped to shreds. 40,000, of course, is an interesting idea, but you have to ask the question, how do we determine that 40,000? And in fact, they just simply reject it. They form another committee, a five-person committee this time, to gather again. And their job is to just allocate representation to each state. So they come back with their recommendation on July 6th. Their recommendation is 56 members for the House of Representatives, what will become the House of Representatives. We're going to put 56 people in there, and we're going to allocate it as follows. One vote each for Rhode Island and Delaware, and then the rest of them get progressively bigger until you're Virginia, which is has nine. Congress can alter that upon the principles of their wealth and number of inhabitants. If you're confused by that, you should be, because the entire convention was confused by that. Roger Sherman stood up and said, wait a sec, on what principle or calculation the report was founded? The offhand response to that was, well, we had a general guide, and that general guide was the number of blacks and whites with some regard to their supposed wealth. Governor Morris added to that that it was pretty much just, a guess. Well, of course, this went over like a lead balloon, and we were left in the same position we were before, with arguing, debating, discussion, going on right down to the road. Patterson of New Jersey challenged counting three-fifths of the slave. Remember, this has already been agreed to, Wilson's bargain some weeks before. But now, he cannot regard Negro slaves in any light except as property. Uh-oh. Here comes the issue. Here it comes. Now someone is going to stand up and actually address the idea of whether or not slaves should be counted at all. Keep in mind that the Southern states, as part of their agreement with Wilson, they want this because it increases their representation, although not as much as counting them as full people would be, which would be all, that would be the best for them. Of course, the non-slave states are against this because, as Patterson is about to say here, he can't see slaves as anything other than property. They are not free agents. They have no personal liberty, no faculty of acquiring property. On the contrary, they are themselves property, and like other property, entirely at will of the master. Has a man in Virginia the same a number of votes in proportion to the number of his slaves? And if Negroes are not represented in the state to which they belong, why should they be represented in the national government? He beckoned his colleagues back to what he called, quote, the true principle of representation, which he said was an expedient by which an assembly chosen by the people is substituted in place of the inconvenient meeting of the people themselves. Since slaves can't vote in such a meeting, they should not be represented, was his point. This little speech here is a micro view of the entirety of the problem. Slaves are, in fact, property. They are not free men. They have no free will. We've talked about this. They have no liberty. They cannot self-determine. They can't do anything that their master doesn't agree to. On the other hand, in the state of Virginia, does George Washington get more votes in his local council because he has X number of slaves, or does a larger slaveholder get more? Of course not. So why should they in the national government count? Since they're property. And if we're going to count wealth, as Rufus King wants to do, well, then I guess they could count as wealth, but they're not property. They're not people. You'd be amazed at the response to this, because the response to this didn't actually come from one of the Southern states, where the Southern states would naturally have argued, of course, that, you know, look, we need that representation. Hopefully you're realizing that there are some logical traps in what Patterson had to say that they should have recognized, and perhaps they did, sitting there. But publicly they never acknowledged that if what Patterson was saying was true, then there were other issues as well. Women, should women not count? I mean, women are not property. They did have the suffrage in New Jersey. Somehow they would lose that in 1807. They did not address the perversity of granting representation to slaves by increasing the influence of those who owned them, thus enhancing the owner's powers of oppression. In other words, Patterson never brought up the fact that if the slave owners had more representation because of the slaves, they would have more power to oppress the slaves. He never made that connection. But it's Madison who actually rises in objection to what Patterson says. Keep in mind that Patterson is from the small state of New Jersey. He is a small stater. He wants equal representation in the Senate. That's what this whole argument and debate is about. But he has just made a passionate argument for proportional representation. And Madison can't wait to stand up and point this out, leaping to his feet. If the gentleman from New Jersey was correct about his doctrine of representation, then that doctrine must forever silence the pretensions of the small states to an equality of votes with the large ones. They, the states, ought to vote in the same proportion in which their citizens would do if the people of all the states were collectively met. It's one of those moments of logical paradox. Madison's right. He's going to win that argument. I mean, there's no two ways about that. He's absolutely correct. If what Patterson is saying is correct about the people of the states ought to vote in these proportions, then sure, proportional representation is the way to go. The problem is, of course, that proportional representation in the Senate means that there is no compromise and there is no Senate because there's no government. And Madison's words, while true, are essentially useless because the moment has been reached where wise men around this room realize we either give the small states equal representation in the Senate or we're not going to have a government at all. And men like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and others who to some degree or another oppose slavery recognize the fact that they can have union with slavery or they can have slavery without union. It's an interesting phrase because that will actually become the argument in Arkansas in 1861. That is actually the slogan that they will use when they go to a referendum to the people of Arkansas. Do you want slavery without union or union without slavery? Of course, they never actually take that vote, but there are men who recognize the fact that we have to have a government, that we have to get this done. And so they have decided behind the scenes to throw in their lot with the small states and agree with the small states. They're going to win. They're going to get equal representation in the Senate. How that works out, we'll have to see. But in the meantime, all the animosity has built up, all the anger has built up, all the insults are flying back and forth. And so we do what any smart convention does. Let's move on to something else for a while. Let's take up something. Let's kind of put this, on the back burner. Let it simmer for a little while, and we'll go on to some other issues, such as how do we figure out how many representatives each person has and or each state has, and so forth. Along with that, but for the moment, it seems like, despite all the anger, despite all the frustration, George Mason's speech has carried the day. And no one is going to give up. I mean, there's a couple of people who are going to give up, but as a whole, the convention will stay together. And they will continue to push forward. And they will bury their bones in Philadelphia rather than walk away from forming a government for the United States of America.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network, copyright MMXV, all rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.